I am unpacking my library. Yes, I am. The books are not yet on the shelves, not yet touched by the mild boredom of order. I cannot march up and down their ranks to pass them in review before a friendly audience. You need not fear any of that. Instead, I must ask you to join me in the disorder of crates that have been wrenched open, the air saturated with the dust of wood, the floor covered with torn paper, to join me among piles of volumes that are seeing daylight again after 2 years of darkness, so that you may be ready to share with me a bit of the mood. It is certainly not an elegiac mood, but rather one of anticipation, which these books arouse in a genuine collector. For such a man is speaking to you, and on close scrutiny he proves to be speaking only about himself. Would it not be presumptuous of me if, in order to appear convincingly objective and down-to-earth, I enumerated for you the main sections or prize pieces of a library, if I presented you with their history or even their usefulness to a writer? I, for one, have in mind something less obscure, something more palpable than that. What I am really concerned with is giving you some insight into the relationship of a book collector to his possessions. Into collecting rather than a collection. If I do this by elaborating on the various ways of acquiring books, this is something entirely arbitrary. This or any other procedure is merely a dam against the spring tide of memories, which surges toward any collector as he contemplates his possessions. Every passion borders on the chaotic, but the collector's passion borders on the chaos of memories. For what else is this collection but a disorder to which habit has accommodated itself to such an extent that it can appear as order? Naturally, his existence is tied to a relationship to objects, which does not emphasize their functional, utilitarian value, that is, their usefulness, but studies and loves them as the scene, the stage of their fate. The most profound enchantment for the collector is the locking of individual terms within a magic circle in which they are fixed as the final thrill. The thrill of acquisition passes over them. Everything remembered and thought, everything conscious becomes the pedestal, the frame, the base, the lock of his property. The period, the region, the craftsmanship, the former ownership. For a true collector, the whole background of an item adds up to a magic encyclopedia whose quintessence is the fate of his object. In this circumscribed area, then, it may be surmised how the great physiognomists, and collectors are the physiognomists of the world of objects, turn into interpreters of fate. One has only to watch a collector handle the objects in his glass case. As he holds them in his hands, he seems to be seeing through them into their distant past, as though inspired. On the last half-emptied case, and it is way past midnight. Other thoughts fill me than the ones I am talking about. Not thoughts, but images, memories. Memories of the cities in which I found so many things. Riga, Naples, Munich, Danzig, Moscow, Florence, Basel, Paris. Oh, bliss of the collector, bliss of the man of leisure, for inside him there are spirits, or at least little genii, which have seen to it that for the collector, and I mean a real collector, a collector as he ought to be, ownership in the most intimate relationship that one can have to objects. Not that they come alive in him, it is he who lives in them. So I have erected one of his dwellings, with books as the building stones before you. And now he is going to disappear inside, as is only fitting.
Four very solid objects A light gray, speckled, with a thin line drawing a diagonal across two of them. One is flat, almost circular. One a squashed square. One a truncated pyramid. And the other a lump into which a curving line is etched. Very solid, very massive, but light. Shiny, silver, two long spikes with pointed ends, a curve with ridges, at the top, a spindle that turns. That opens the two legs or closes them. Its tool, a precise tool.
Oh.
Gentle, swirling shapes.
Thank you.
every book room.
Thank you. Thank you. I guess I have to speak to him. Can you hear me?
Thank you.
it's not that I didn't care if they didn't, you know, whether they knew or not. Of course, I'm always really excited when someone knows who the dude was. It's okay if you didn't know. That this is your first experience of all time. It's John reading the text, and you get whatever that, and seeing our relationship to objects.
The voice modifier at the beginning, the first, in the opening, was that their particular purpose? Is that the particular purpose?
Yes, there are a couple things. One is that she's supposed to be dead, Walter Benjamin. and I needed like a quick way to do that, and I had a, without torturing Mikey to make me a max cash to do it, so I was like, I've got a hand pedal, and I'm going to use it, and I realized that when her voice is pitch shifted down an octave, you actually don't really understand a lot of the text unless you're right near her and you can hear her real voice. So we were trying to play this time with her being more on mic and off mic so that you would go in and out of being able to hear the text. But on the other hand, this whole idea of what we understand and how is one of the questions, this act of translation is one of the questions, one of the bigger questions of the piece. And yes, it would be great if you understood everything in the text, but it's also interesting to figure out what you understand just from the way she's saying it and the few words that creep out that you do hear and how that compares to what Shane is, you know, like our relationship to the objects. And so it's sort of like a different way of understanding what she's saying, you know, in case you don't really hear every word that she's saying. Because I realize that you probably wouldn't with that kind of process. So part of it is that I wanted it to be Walter Benjamin.